This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. Today is the first part in our new series, which is going to look at Harlan Ellison, specifically his work on The Outer Limits. But today, we're not going to be looking at The Outer Limits, we're going to be looking at his one episode of Star Trek, which is The City on the Edge of Forever. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are joined by Drew of Standard Orbit. How's it going, Drew?
It's fantastic.
And John of Words with Nerds. How's it going, John?
I am so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy that you're here, too. Thanks for joining us, guys. So, City on the Edge of Forever. It was the, depending on how you count, 29th episode of Star Trek, the original series, the second to the last episode to air in season one, I believe. And it is commonly considered to be the Citizen Kane of Star Trek.
I would dispute that, but I wouldn't know where to start.
Citizen Kane, best movie ever made. Mm-hmm. City on the Edge of Forever, best Star Trek episode ever made. Mm-hmm. So, I guess the question is it the best Star Trek episode ever made? What do you think, Drew?
I can't speak for all of the other franchises, just the one that I'm responsible for on the network. And I would say, yeah. What I appreciate is that it's got the plot, it's got time travel, it's got love, but it also has a little bit of humor. And I appreciate that, especially Spock, you know, disparaging the lack of technology. Mm-hmm. and describing things as, you know, flint knives and bear skins.
Right.
Yeah.
What about you, John? What are your thoughts on City on the Edge of Forever?
Well, I think it's completely fair to say that it deserves, especially in the context of the original series, a seat at the table or a part of the discussion as the best episode. Whether you're going to feel that it's the best episode, of course, all depends on your own point of view. And with Drew, I completely agree. The element of humor that's there is, I think if you go back and you look at it, especially the first scene where they're discovered and Kirk comes up with that lie about Spock's ears and how they got mangled in like a rice picking machine or whatever. You see the first real glimmers of that chemistry that was there all that many years later in Star Trek IV. That sort of on the fly, like very relaxed comedy that mannerism that Shatner has sort of naturally.
I was disappointed that he almost got hit by a car and he didn't yell "double dumbass" on you. Well, I kind of expected that.
Yeah, right. But I think that it has a lot of charm, and it also, I mean, for me, the emotional connection is that in terms of like a science fiction television show, I remember being of the age when I finally saw it to sort of be blown away by the whole concept of, you know, having to make the decision to let a good person die so that history can unfold in the proper way. Like that was kind of mind blowing. You know, that whole the implication of her death in life just was really intense. And so the episode as a whole, you know, I think it's completely fair to say, like, I can see why somebody would say it's their favorite one.
I could see that too.
Yeah.
What about you, Max?
It took me a while to even get to the point where I could analyze the original series episodes objectively because I saw them all before I knew that it was a thing that wasn't real. But when I got older, I watched that episode while watching through the series a few times, and every time I watch it, I realize that there's just a little bit more genius in it than I thought there was before. And I analyze it from a different point of view. And lately, I've just been sort of in awe of how ahead of the game Harlan Ellison was in a lot of interesting ways. And that, like, he was making a comment about this utopian society by, like, saying that you don't get there clean, that everything kind of is chaotic, and history is often kind of stupid, and bad things happen that lead to good things, and sometimes that's really unfortunate. And that's a really weird thing to talk about in Star Trek, and I find it interesting that, like, the controversy is all sort of about, like, the nature of the future and how Roddenberry changed a lot of things to make the future cleaner. And that's all really interesting in the context, because of the episode, like, every version of it maintained, like, the same sort of, like, moral point of view, that there is a good and there's a bad, and history is often not clean.
Well, I'm with all of you guys. I also think that it is an excellent episode. I'm not necessarily sure that I would rank it as the best either, but I definitely would put it in top 10. I know a lot of people respond to it because of the sort of emotional impact of the love story and things like that. But to me, I think the thing that I like about it the most is how it's not morally clean in a sense. You know, there isn't necessarily a right and wrong that's, let's say, black and white. You know, I mean, the idea of having to let this really, really good person die because her kindness, her goodness, will make the world a better place for a very short time, and then a worse place for a very, very long time, is really, really strange, you know, good. It makes you, it really sort of makes you think about things.
But it's definitely, there's definitely still, like, a clear right and wrong. It's just a really dirty right.
I guess that's what it is. Yeah, you know?
And that's what's really fascinating about it. I mean, like, I could go on about how interesting it is seeing Kirk and Spock in the past, and then what was essentially contemporary, you know, America, and how he must have at some point while they were doing this said, "Hey, Jim, this hat really works for covering up my ears. If we ever end up in the past again, we got to totally get me one of these hats."
You know, just to add on really quick, I think also something that's easily overlooked is because he's, you know, sick and sort of like Bones is almost a MacGuffin at a certain point in the episode, but sort of throwing, I think, into real stark contrast the pure emotional aspect of Bones while he's sick versus the pure logic of Spock really coming into stark relief and really clearly defining. I think that City on the Edge of Forever very clearly casts that triangle, you know. And again, that echoes later in the Genesis argument in Star Trek II, because Bones gets really worked up during that argument, and Spock's very, very even keel, and Kirk is the one that has to straddle, which of course is, you know, of course that's the relationship between the three. But I think that City Bones really adds an element to it to really define those characters further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how that sort of the id superego id dynamic evolved over time, and I'm tempted to say that, you know, Harlan Ellison realized it and incorporated it into the narrative, but I'm also aware that it's pretty likely that people just saw that it worked and went with it. Yeah, but it was definitely hugely influential either way.
So the history of this episode is probably more infamous than any other episode in Star Trek's entire history.
You don't need to put probably.
No, okay, it is, yeah.
That's a fact. We could put that in stone.
Yeah.
There is a lot of behind-the-scenes conflict which went into getting this episode made, more specifically getting this script written. It was very early on when Ellison was hired by Roddenberry to write a script for Star Trek, any script. Ellison was one of a number of writers who watched Where No Man Has Gone Before, and based on that, pitched some ideas, I guess, and this was one of them. And Roddenberry, you know, bought the idea and commissioned Ellison to write it. And while everyone agreed that the script was undoubtedly the best that they had for that first season, it was also not getting written in a timely fashion and not necessarily meshing with the series on the whole. And this led to a number of rewrites by a number of people who weren't Harlan Ellison. And this led to Harlan Ellison being rather upset with the finished product.
Rather upset is the appropriate term.
Oh, yeah.
If yeah. we were on NPR.
So in the 90s, Ellison published the original screenplay, which won a Writers Guild Award for best drama,
thing.
I guess.
Oh, that's a good word.
Best thing ever.
That year, yeah. And he did so in order to kind of, you know, I think for one thing, just because he wanted to get that version out there, his version out to the public, but also he wanted to kind of show how it differed from what aired and maybe shed some light on why he wasn't too happy with the finished product. So as far as the differences are concerned between the original version and the aired version, one of them has to do with a drug dealer and a drug addict that sort of act as a catalyst for the entire episode.
It's so, a drug deal gone bad is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Max, can you kind of explain what was going on with that scenario?
Well, the first draft, I don't remember what the drugs were, but they were an incredibly strangely named thing.
The Jewels of Sound.
That's it. Oh. That's crazy. Harlan Ellison is a crazy person, because only a crazy person could come up with such an amazing name for a sci-fi drug. Come on, that's so much better than bath salts. Why don't we call them the Jewels of Sound? That would explain eating a person's face. But... like, that scenario involved, obviously it involved drug deals, and obviously it involved illegal drugs, which opens a lot of weird boxes. So you have to credit the writers on the show for recognizing that that would not be a good can of worms to open up on this new series.
Well, certainly the other aspect to that was that Gene Roddenberry and his utopian society certainly would not have drug-addicted crew members or drug-dealing crew members on the flagship of the fleet. When the drug-addicted crew member puts the ship in jeopardy and sees the error in his ways and decides that he's going to fess up to Captain Kirk, the drug dealer is not happy about that and kills him and then tries to leave the ship, tries to abandon ship and beams down to the planet where a slightly different version of the Guardian is.
Guardians. There's another aspect to all of this, like all the controversy of the drug dealing and the court martial and all that stuff. The other aspect is it's a TV show and there's a time travel plot, and that's a whole bunch of exposition to get Kirk and Spock to jump through a door.
And that is the other thing, which is kind of weird, is that in the original draft, Kirk and Spock do not go back in time until Act 3, I think.
Which is nuts.
That's like halfway through the episode.
Which is nuts. Mm-hmm. It is nuts on a lot of different levels, but on the production of a TV show level, I have no problem believing that a lot of the rewrites were people just going, we cannot shoot this.
So it's not McCoy who jumps through the portal, not McCoy, you know, accidentally injecting himself with, what is it called? What's the name of the shot? It's not like cortisone. No.
Tetra?
Tetracortisone.
It has a zone,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, whatever it
begins
it is.
With a C. Oh.
It's not
Cordrazine.
Him. Cordrazine.
I just made that up.
It could be right.
it's actually like Max, you might have hit that one.
Yeah.
I've done it before. Ballerino. Made it up. Turned out to be true.
But it's not McCoy who, you know, in a crazed, drug-induced state, jumps through the portal. It's a criminal, a murderer, murdering drug dealer who jumps through the portal. So after he does this, the Guardians start freaking out because they're like, he could have messed up time. We're not positive on this, but it could have happened. So Kirk and Spock decide to, along with Yeoman Rand, decide to beam back up to the Enterprise, which is still there. And what they find is essentially the Mirror Universe. When you think about it, it's space pirates. The name of the ship is the Condor, and they are going to kill these intruders who are standing in their transporter room.
It's Cordrazine.
It is Cordrazine. Okay,
that's disturbing.
It's at that point that with Yeoman Rand and a few other crew members barricaded in the transporter room, Spock and Kirk decide to travel back in time, and then we get what is essentially the same story. There are a few other changes, though. First off, there's a character which, to me, I don't see this as being a significant change, but apparently Harlan Ellison saw it as being a huge deal. There is a character that shows up with about 10 minutes left in the episode, probably, who's named Trooper. And he is a World War I vet who, I think he's a double amputee. Mm-hmm. And he's just on the street, kind of like, you know, begging for change. And there's a moment where, you know, Kirk asks for his help, offers to give him a few dollars in order to help him out. And basically, for what it sounds like, it probably was the first time since this guy returned home from the war, is shown a level of respect that he deserves. And he, in turn, you know, helps Kirk and Spock track down this murdering drug dealer. Mm-hmm. There's some other stuff that goes on in there, some stuff about like him accidentally, like he's the guy who accidentally kills himself, or maybe he doesn't kill himself, maybe he's just shot by the phaser. He dies.
He pushes like Kirk out of the way of a phaser blast.
That's what it is. Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay. And he dies. And there's a whole thing about how that death did not affect the timeline because he was insignificant, and I'm sure that there's some social commentary going on with that stuff, but the character of Trooper apparently was one of Harlan Ellison's favorite creations ever from the way he was talking about it, although I'm assuming that's kind of how he talks about most of his stories. And the fact that he was eliminated in future drafts really upset him.
Well, I think it makes a kind of sense to be upset by the idea of eliminating a character who you specifically said exists primarily to illustrate the marginalization of that type of person. And then they're like, let's cut that marginalized character. And you're like, are you not aware of what you just said? Fine, I'm the crazy one.
I guess that's true. Do you guys have any thoughts on the character of Trooper?
I think the character of Trooper was, you know, sounds like it was a great concept, but at the same time, what I think what Ellison betrays about himself in talking about Trooper is, is there a single writer, especially working in TV or film, that has not had to cut a character or seen something cut that they thought was the greatest idea ever, but you know, whether it was for time constraints, whether it was for a story, you know, to lean the story up or like make things, you know, progress quicker. Like characters and scripts get rewritten. Characters get cut. Lines get rewritten on set, you know, like all the time. And it's like for him to carry that much of a grudge about the one character, you know, and like because I think he says in the introduction to City on the Edge, like, I still weep for Trooper. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, surely there have been other, like you've done other work, and I'm sure that there have been other instances where things have been cut. Like, maybe I just don't have the vision that he does of how wonderful the character was, but, you know, like, it sounds like a really interesting character, but at the same time, let it go, man.
There is one more change, which is probably the biggest change which was made to the story. Not probably, again, I'm sure that I can eliminate that. It definitely is the biggest change which was made to the story, and that's the ending. In the version which aired, McCoy sees that Edith is about to get run over by a truck. Mm-hmm. He goes to stop her, and Kirk, knowing what that means, knowing what he has to do, intentionally holds McCoy back and lets Edith die. Now, Drew, can you help me out? What happened in the original screenplay?
So in the original screenplay, we've got the same kind of situation. Edith is walking back across the road, but the drug dealer slash murderer, whose entire point, they've been afraid of him wanting to kill Edith, so they've been like protecting her. He's going to save her from the truck, and Kirk moves to save Edith, and Spock pulls Kirk and the murderer back. And so it's all on Spock, and Kirk was going to save Edith and sacrifice the future for his love. Even in the end, even after knowing all the consequences, he was still going to do it and was unwilling to sacrifice her in the end. And that is completely different. That changes everything.
Yes. And, you know, that was what it was supposed to be about, you know, the idea that Kirk was so in love with this woman that he was willing to give up everything, and that Spock was the one who was the logical one, in right. a sense. And then there was going to be a moment afterwards when they were back safe on the Enterprise where Spock goes to Kirk's quarters. He calls him Jim for the first and only time, and he says that no one ever loved a woman so much as you, because you were willing to give up the universe for her, or something to that effect.
Very Hallmark.
So what are your thoughts on the original screenplay? Do you think it's good, bad, better, worse? John?
I don't think that it's either better or worse. I think that both versions work. They say things in a different fashion. And yes, it's super cool that Spock would have called Jim. You know, for the first time, would have said, called him Jim, and it would have, you know, rooted him and humanized him and thrown in a subtler way than they usually did the struggle he had with his humanity. So that's cool. But the ending as it is very cool as well. Like, I even love the way that it's cut. You know, the reaction shots, everything about it, I think, just works so well that I can't hold anything against it. I think both have merit.
What about you, Drew?
I'm going to say that the original version, I can see why it would win awards and why Harlan is so proud of it. It's very good. But most of the changes, if not all of them, make it better. Or at least make it better Star Trek. Even Harlan says that had they kept the original ending, it would have changed. It would have required continuity. It would have required people to bring this up again, because it would have changed Kirk. It would have changed all of the dynamics, and that just wouldn't work because it was an anthology show. We really need to push the reset button. I think that there's enough subtlety that you can really, from that point on, you can kind of in your mind see how it shapes Kirk. Something I've realized recently is that Kirk is all about sacrificing himself before he sacrifices someone else. And it's not very Kirk-like to sacrifice a whole world for the sake of one person, because I feel that Kirk, as we get to know him throughout the series and movies, is about sacrificing himself or wanting to. He's always hurt when someone's sacrificed in his place.
What about you, Max?
We're sort of talking about it like a really sort of big elliptical fashion, but what we're talking about is a scene where a bus hits a woman.
Mm-hmm.
and we're talking about who may or may not have jumped into the street and shoved her out of the way. Like, that is the scene that we're talking about, and there's a version of this scene that involves a random stranger who shoves her out of the way of the bus so that she doesn't die. And he's a bad guy, and he doesn't know her role in history, and the idea is just, if she's a chick and he's going to be hit by a bus, obviously you push her out of the way. If you can, you push her out of the way. That's what you do. You don't need, like, a complicated sci-fi backstory to do that. And the whole story is really, really complicated. The original version, like, you couldn't even describe it. you had a hard time just putting the pieces together, just describing it. Imagine that as a dramatic scene in a TV show where the audience is thinking, wait a minute, hold on. That's the guy from the beginning with the drugs, and she's, okay, so he's gonna, right, and Kirk's not, stop, okay, because he's gonna, that she's gonna cause the, okay, I get it. Now, the rewrite makes so much sense, because it's like, she's gonna screw up the future. That's it. That simplifies it so much, and it makes the dramatic stakes essentially comprehensible.
Yeah, but to speak to a point you brought up earlier about Ellison being ahead of his time, I could see this very complex sort of script in the modern era where we have series like Breaking Bad.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
This script, even closer to the original, not the bare bones original. The original version he wrote, I agree, is way too complex and works better as a novel. Like, if this had been a novel or even a movie...
If it was a movie, it would be amazing.
It would have been fantastic. But I think they could pull that... I think they could have pulled this off if, like, Star Trek had been something that... Well, TV today wouldn't exist without... blah, blah. So, let's say... let's roll it back and
let's
say...
Let's go to the Guardian of Forever and go back in time to the 60s and remake Star Trek as a continuity-driven series.
We'll create a thing longer and then ask the what-if machine a couple of questions.
Great. You just made a paradox.
Thank you. You know, I think that today they could pull this off. They could pull this off even in an hour-long episode. A couple of changes here and there, which would probably still send Ellison into a tailspin. And he
would because Trooper would be the first thing to go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Vince Gilligan would cut Trooper, and then Ellison would talk about how terrible Vince Gilligan was and what a hack. But, you know, like, I think it's a victim of its time. I think that Ellison was too forward-thinking. He was too ahead of it. Ahead of the curve, and you know he wrote a script that was meant for 40 years later.
Yeah, it was really not filmable for a lot of reasons, not just like at a production level, just on like a like an actual getting the actors to know what they're doing from scene to scene level, because it's crazy dense.
There is a lot of stuff in there. There's a lot of stuff which I think if Star Trek would have adopted. Would have been interesting. Like a lot of the there's a lot of like direction in there. It's almost like he has like a shot list in this thing, and it is much more abstract than Star Trek really ever was.
My favorite part of the script is the fact that I don't remember if it was in the final script or if it was one of the earlier drafts. They mention we've got to adjust our universal translators because. Yeah. You know, it's 400 years in the past, and the language has changed, which is great, because it would be like if we went back to King James English, you know, it would be great if we had a universal translator to understand what they were talking about.
Yeah.
I really like that concept of using the universal translator on English.
Yeah. By doing that, though, you're opening a whole can of worms.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten into it before.
We've discussed those worms.
Yeah. Yes.
And the spice that they could produce.
Well, for me, I do like both versions for sure. I think that if it were a true anthology show, the original version is probably better. I think sort of the interesting questions of morality that it asks and things like that are really interesting, are more interesting than some of the ones which are asked in the finished product. However, I think a lot of the logic issues which the original script had were taken care of in the finished product. It's much more streamlined, and I think it also is much more Star Trek, the characters and everything. And you know, it would be interesting to see, like, if a season of Star Trek had already existed and Harlan Ellison had seen all those episodes and then he went in to write this in season two, like how it would be different. Like, would he have a better handle on what the characters were meant to be, and would he be able to tell the story differently? I don't know. It would be interesting. But on the whole, I think that the finished product is superior. Okay, so now this book, the screenplay, it has an essay which is very long. And it's basically Harlan Ellison telling his side of the story as to what happened and why he hates Gene Roddenberry and how Gene Roddenberry has lied about the reasons behind the changes and everything for years and years. And I can understand why he's upset, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of personal stuff going on there, which I'm sure he would say, yes, yes, that's the whole point, idiot, don't you get it? But that goes beyond the actual work. What do you guys think about Harlan Ellison's beef with Roddenberry or the essay about it? John?
I think that Ellison, you know, I said earlier, Ellison needs to learn to let things go. Things change with scripts. But I will say that the first time I read it, it was eye-opening because I had sort of consumed the Kool-Aid with regards to the Roddenberry mythos. And it was the first time, personally, that I read anything that didn't just try to poke a hole in it, but was somebody coming with a sledgehammer to bash the statue. As much vitriol as in it, and as much as you might say he went overboard, it was somebody willing to say this guy was no less human than anybody else. Now, did he go too far? You know, that's open for debate and everything like that. But I still think it's important to be able to read something like this about somebody who is very much lionized for what was overall a group effort. And Ellison, at the very least, illustrates that those people deserved as much credit as possible for Roddenberry's vision even being loved as much as it was.
What about you, Drew?
Well, I agree with John, but I think that it could have been handled less offensively. I mean, there's a difference between, look, Gene said it like this. It's not exactly the truth. This is what happened from my point of view. I don't think that's fair. As opposed to all of the stupid people out there who worship Gene Roddenberry, the great bird of the galaxy, and they're all stupid people, and the stupid Star Trek fans reading this book, and I hope you choke on it. It's like he was threatening his very readers. Like I didn't appreciate that. I appreciated the content. Like it was great to hear the story, but like him calling out Shatner for having a ghostwriter, it was unnecessarily, well, maybe for Harlan, necessarily offensive.
What about you, Max?
I actually understand the rewrite as being much more of a pragmatic thing than anything else. Like a lot of the changes seem completely determined by plausibility, shootability, it makes sense this way, making it simpler for an audience. That there's a lot of rational decisions that went into that rewrite. And a lot of the controversy, I think, stems from a weird aspect of Harlan Ellison being much smarter than he knows. He has an astonishing memory and thinks about things much more deeply than anyone else around him. And very often it comes off like he's some sort of aggressive Obi-Wan who sees the subtext and everything when it really isn't there. He's seeing connections that we couldn't possibly see because we just don't think the way he does. And the reason he's so great at what he does is because he thinks the way he does. That's why Harlan Ellison is going to always be an iconoclastic kind of character. He's going to smash things and he's going to make a mess and he's going to do amazing stuff because that's what happens when you find somebody who's talented because they think differently. And it's worth it.
Okay. For me, I had a very similar reaction to John. I read this when I was really young, when it first came out in mass market trade paperback, I guess, which was like 1996, which meant I was 16 years old. I had been watching Star Trek for about 3 years, and I was just kind of starting to dip my toes in the waters of filmmaking and realizing that Gene Roddenberry did not do every single episode of the original series and every episode of Next Generation until he died. And there were a lot of people who were involved in a lot of this stuff. And maybe Gene Roddenberry wasn't, you know, the saint that everyone sort of makes him out to be. And reading this book, I was like, wow, this was like the first time there was this, and then there was an article about the writing of Star Trek the Motion Picture, which I also read right around this time, that kind of really influenced my outlook on Gene Roddenberry for years and years to come. And I started thinking, like, this guy, maybe he wasn't really good at all. Maybe he was terrible. Maybe Star Trek is good despite Gene Roddenberry. And, you know, now I can look back at it with even more distance and more perspective and see that the truth lies in between, of course. And I shouldn't necessarily believe everything that I read or whatever I read last, you know, because, you know, there are multiple sides to a story, and just because one guy says the other guy is wrong doesn't mean that he's 100% right either. So that's about all the time that we have today for City on the Edge of Forever. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about on Trek.fm. Here's some stuff that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Gene Roddenberry.
I appreciate Gene Roddenberry as a creator because he had a vision and he stuck to it, unlike other creators of other franchises that we won't get into.
Who are you talking about, Drew?
Not George Lucas.
Earl Grey.
Romance on TNG.
I got the four pips. I'm ready to settle down now. It wasn't until then that I could get stay with one woman.
So instead of rings, do they use that last pip on his collar as the signal of their eternal love and devotion together?
The orb.
Bajoran prophecies.
Well, you know, I was thinking that Horan was probably not so much a prophet as a Bajoran songwriter who just wrote really bad lyrics.
The Ready Room.
Faces.
What you brought up is the exact reason why I like this episode so much, because the essential message is we have to have our good and our not-so-hot qualities to make us who we are. We have to deal with them. And this is just a very extreme version of that.
To the journey!
Workforce Rewrite.
And I'm totally with you about Jaffin. He is like Mark version 2.0. He's just like, he's a little too laid back. He's a little too quick to buy into all of this. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, dude, grow a pair. I like the way you put that.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Black and Cushman, Part 2.
So they were trying to find a replacement, not to play Spock, but to play another Vulcan who would be assigned to the Enterprise.
Whoa.
And one of the guys they were considering was David Carradine, who went on
what?
To
play. Oh, my God.
Warp 5.
Continuity and consequences.
It was a place that you generally don't expect Star Trek to go with a major character for sure, and certainly not for the period of time that it went on, because, you know, it starts in Fusion. She becomes infected with this Pinar syndrome, and then that even leads her to drug addiction.
Trek News and Views.
Looking back at TNP.
Oh, okay, we're still talking TMP. I was thinking Janeway's Pink Nighty.
I know, it's like, what?
Oh, Janeway's Pink Nighty, OBQ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you seem to like it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and before, yeah. Yeah. That was a nice nighty.
Literary Treks.
You'll win.
It has two sides to it. You know, you can read it as just the fun yacht race, which I thought, the Federation has a biannual sailing competition? I did not know this.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get your daily Trek talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/PD for podcast directory to get all the links. So Drew, you do one of those shows.
With you.
With me. It's called Standard Orbit. It's about the original series.
It's awesome. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So where else can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE. And they can find me on various episodes of The Ready Room and Trek News and Views and, you know, just around. Just keep an eye out.
Yeah. And if you get bored of listening to Drew, you can listen to John on Words with Nerds.
Please listen to me on Words with Nerds. and my illustrious co-host Craig. We're at nerdsword.podbean.com. You can also find us on iTunes, and we're hoping to expand out, but it's two guys doing their best. And you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KesselJunkie. And I pretty much live on Twitter, I guess. You'll see me from time to time. And then also patrolling the streets of Gotham when necessary.
Before we go, we have a sponsor now for commentary, Trek Stars, and it is audible.com.
That seems appropriate.
Yeah. Next week, we're going to be talking about Harlan Ellison's Outer Limits episode Soldier.
Yes.
Which was based on a short story that Ellison wrote called Soldier from Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to be talking about the short story as well. And I realize that a lot of people probably haven't read the short story. Well, if you go to audible.com, you can buy the short story, download it, listen to it, and be all ready for next week's episode.
It really seems like you should. It would be a moral failing if they didn't do that.
Honestly, that's what I did, because I hadn't read the short story, and I was like, well, I could get it, you know, and read it.
Yeah.
Like, with my eyes.
Yeah.
Or I could listen to it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's what I did. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week, from classics like Harlan Ellison's Soldier to current bestsellers. Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic books you've yet to read, or that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek FM. So that's about it for this week. As always, you can find us on Trek FM, or you can find us on our website, CommentaryTrackStars.com, mm-hmm. where we do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic with our friend Brandon, or you can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars.
Yes.
So next week is part two in our series on Harlan Ellison, where we're going to be talking about his first Outer Limits episode, Soldier, and the short story, Soldier from Tomorrow, which, by the way, if you're looking for it on Audible, it's Soldier. They retitled it. It's Soldier.
It's been retitled for a very long time.
Yes. So read up on that and be all ready for next week, and we're going to be talking some Outer Limits.